From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, this is Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors, and welcome to this week's edition of Naps Chat. We're going to be doing something a little bit different today. Ordinarily, when we look at the legislative process, we study it from the vantage point of Capitol Hill, that is, what happens in the House and what happens in the Senate. Today, we are privileged to have a presidential scholar and a practitioner of White House public policy, Tevi Troy, who is a presidential scholar, who has written a number of books on the presidency. Most recently, he wrote a book entitled Fight House, which is a discussion of stark disagreements within the White House. And welcome to Naps Chat, Tevi.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me a little bit your background. What did you do in the White House? How did you end up in the White House? And how did you fall into public policy?
Sure. I caught the public policy bug early after I graduated college. I went to Cornell in the late 80s. I moved to Washington and I got my first job at the American Enterprise Institute. And I looked around at the scholars at American Enterprise Institute and was very impressed with what they were doing. And I thought, that's pretty cool. How do I get to be where those guys are? And I saw that they all had advanced degrees and that they had all worked in government and that they had all written well-received books or articles. So I went about trying to do those things. I got a PhD at University of Texas. I focused on presidential history. I started working in government. I was on the House side, then the Senate side. Then I worked in the White House and the executive branch. And then I also wrote a number of books. I've written 4 books, as you said, on the presidency, including my latest Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump.
One of the what I found to be very interesting about your career is that, you made from Capitol Hill. You worked for Senator John Ashcroft from Missouri and moved over to the White House. And you were the assistant to the president or acting assistant to the president for policy and the deputy assistant to the president of policy. And during your tenure, postal issues and postal legislation came up. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. When I was at the White House, the issue of postal reform did come up. President Bush was particularly interested in the subject because of the fiscal challenges that the post office was facing, and he was very concerned about those issues. He was the first MBA president, and he wanted to make sure we could put the post office on a good fiscal footing. I had a staffer who worked under me named Jess Sharp, who was our lead person on postal reform, and he was the one who would keep me up to date on what was going on in the postal reform area, and he's a very skilled and smart guy. Also, occasionally he would bring by Jack Potter, who was the Postmaster General at the time, to talk to me about their concerns on postal reform. And we had some good conversations and developed a bit of a rapport because we were both big baseball fans.
A fan of what team would that be?
Well, I'm a big fan of the New York Yankees. And he actually gave me a poster of all of the stamps that the post office had ever done with Yankees on it. I still have it to this day. And, as with all things in the White House, I had to give it first to the White House Counsel's Office to get their permission as to whether I could receive this gift. And apparently, you are allowed to receive gifts from government agency to government agency, although not from outside individuals. So the White House Counsel ruled that I could keep the gift, and I still have it on my wall to this day.
Also, during your tenure, the anthrax issue came up, that is, the contamination of a number of postal facilities from anthrax. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement in that and the President George W. Bush's interest in that matter?
Yeah, absolutely. President Bush was alerted to the issue of the anthrax mailings. Remember, that's how the anthrax poisonings in the early 2000s, right? Not long after 9/11, were spread. And we didn't know if they were connected. It turns out they were almost certainly not connected. We've identified with, I would say, 99% certainty who did it, but never 100% certainty, because the person who we think did the anthrax mailings killed himself before there was a trial and the completion of the investigation. But it was not related to Islamist terror, but President Bush was concerned about post office issues then. Also, it was a good time to be looking at postal issues. It was before email had been as widely proliferated as it is now. You also didn't have the Amazon issues. And so at the time, the Americans still relied on the post office for communication in a way that they don't quite as much today. And so it was a good time to be looking at postal reform. I don't think we actually quite got it done, but It was a good effort.
While you were at the White House, there were an infinite number of public policy issues that could come across the president's desk or actually come through your office in the policy unit. Can you tell me how a particular piece of legislation or an issue comes to the attention of the White House and that they run with it?
Yeah, there's a variety of ways. Sometimes somebody comes into the White House with a particular interest and they will raise the issue. Sometimes there are issues that are just proliferating in the mainstream media and we recognize we have to address them. Sometimes there's a piece of legislation that's moving pretty quickly. And I know you've talked about legislation on the podcast before. The president's role is interesting and early in that he doesn't develop the legislation. The White House doesn't usually develop legislation, but they often do issue something called a SAP or a statement of administration policy. And that sends a signal to Capitol Hill of what the White House is willing to bear, given that the president has veto power, and it's very rare that we have veto-proof majorities for anything in current Congress. The Congress needs to know where the president is on something so that they don't waste time passing legislation that they have no chance of getting signed into law.
Also, during your tenure, the White House took an interest in the Postal Service, and there was the creation of the Presidential Commission on the Postal Service, which was run out of the Department of the Treasury. How did the Treasury Department end up with the postal portfolio?
Well, the Treasury Department is in charge of the money, and they are supposed to make sure that the U.S. government has enough money to handle its obligations. That's why you hear all these, every once in a while we have to raise the debt limit, and it's the Treasury Department that's in charge of that. There was a time back in history when the Postmaster General was a member of the president's cabinet, but now it is, as you know, an independent agency, and it stands separate and apart. So the person within the administration or the agency within the administration that handles post office issues is generally the Treasury.
One of the distinctions between, I think, the current interest in the Postal Service by President Trump and, I believe, former President George W. Bush was that President Bush was not necessarily interested in postal operations. He was more interested in the financial impact of the financial interaction between the Postal Service and the Treasury, as well as anthrax. Was he interested in operational issues of the Postal Service as the current president is?
Yeah, I can't really speak to the current White House, but I will say that President Bush, his main interest was on the fiscal issues. As I said, he was the first MBA president, got an MBA from Harvard, and wanted to make sure that we as a nation were on firm financial footing. Didn't always work out as well as we would have liked, but we were better in terms of debt back then than we are today, I would say. And I think that was really the driver of his interest in postal reform.
To your book on the Fight House, that it's not always that presidential assistants and folks in the cabinet agree on all issues. Now, I don't know if that's the case with regard to the Postal Service or was the case of the Postal Service in the Bush administration or is currently the issue within the Trump administration. But can you talk to us a little bit about disagreements in the White House, whether or not that sort of moves issues forward or it hinders the consideration of issues?
Yeah, I would say there's a continuum. In my book, In Fight House, I talk about how there are some administrations that don't allow any disagreement, and in those, it's kind of stultifying. You can't really have a full and open conversation about issues and what are different perspectives. An example of this is really Lyndon Johnson administration. He did not brook disagreement on the Vietnam War, and as a result, he didn't have full and open conversations on the Vietnam War, and there were problematic policies as a result. Then there are other administrations on the other side of the continuum, like the Ford administration, that really are something like 900 days of out-and-out warfare, where people are leaking everything to the press, and people are undercutting each other. There's even some physical violence that I talk about in Fight House, and that is also an unmanageable approach. So you need to find a way where you can have open and honest discussions about disagreements and resolve them, and then once they are resolved, people can lock arms and go say, this is the president's policy. We may have disagreed when we got to the table, but at least we each had our voices heard, and now we can go forward with the policy in unanimity.
Lingering disagreements amongst assistants to the president, that could be a problem, can it not?
Oh, yes, festering disagreements are a problem. Sometimes you have instances of people not talking to each other, people leaking to the press about one another. I've even found instances of people leaking to the press about one another and then complaining that the person who was leaked about did the leaking, when indeed it was the person who was doing the complaining that did the leaking. So it gets very complicated. It gets very intense. And the more you have it, it can really fester and undermine an administration's ability to get things done.
One of the interesting, I think, incidents that you bring up in your book was an instance with regard to soon-to-be Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and Jill St. John and President Nixon. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that was the result of some disagreement between the Secretary of State at the time, Rogers, and I guess he was National Security Advisor at that point, Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, Kissinger actually successfully supplanted Rogers and became the only person to be both National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. Nobody else has ever done that. But Kissinger was a master of this kind of misdirected leak that I mentioned. So at one point, he is indeed dating Jill St. John, a very attractive actress who was a Bond girl.
Tiffany Chase from Diamonds Are Forever, as I recall.
Right. Very nice. Anyway, so Kissinger complains to Nixon that it's in the papers that he's dating Jill St. John, and he blames Rogers for leaking this information that he's dating this Bond girl. And the truth is that Kissinger did the leaking, and he did it for two reasons. One is he's dating a Bond girl, Jill St. John. He wants the world to know it. But the second reason is that he wanted to undercut Rogers in the interwars between state and NSA. And he obviously successfully did so, since he ended up as the Secretary of State supplanting Rogers. So that was one of those tricky maneuvers that White House aides use against each other that I highlight in my book, Fight House.
Do you think that's going on right now?
It's always going on. That's really the point of Fight House. I urge your listeners to buy a copy. It's a totally fun read. And it really looks at this issue of infighting, and it shows that it's a perennial issue in American politics. Again, some presidents handle it better than others, some administrations handle it better than others, but I found no administration that had no infighting. It's always going to be so.
One of the other series of events that you speak about, in fact, I found an article that you had written back in 2017 about health crises confronting the United States, for example, polio, and you wrote another book about how presidents confronted crises. Could you talk a little bit about that within the context of the current pandemic this country is facing?
Yeah, and that book was Shall We Wake the President? It's a history of presidents and disasters, how they deal with disasters. And I look at this issue of a pandemic and how a president can deal with it. And look, the fact of the matter is that a president cannot make the vaccine or administer an antiviral or prevent a disease from coming to our shores. Those are beyond the president's capabilities. The president can communicate to the American people about the nature of the threat, give them instructions about some things they should do, and reassure the American people. So what I found in Shall We Wake the President is that a president has an important role, but it's more of a communications and managerial role rather than a medical role. And when people think, oh, there's a virus and the president hasn't stopped it, that's an unrealistic expectation. You can say there's a virus and the president hasn't appropriately communicated what the challenges are. That is within the president's realm. So I think when you're looking at presidency and whether they're doing a good job with the virus, you need to look at what their appropriate role is. And I do talk in the book about Woodrow Wilson in the 1918 flu, for which he did a horrible job. 675,000 Americans died. The life expectancy of the average American dropped by a decade as a result of that flu. And Woodrow Wilson, as far as historians can tell, did not issue a single public statement about it, did not give any warnings, did not tell the American people what was going on, did not appear to direct any medical efforts against this flu. And so I would say that was a really disastrous response and the kind of thing we should avoid going forward.
Does history judge him unfavorably because of that event or that failure to act on the 1918 flu pandemic?
The truth is that the 1918 flu pandemic was kind of forgotten for almost 90 years and really not talked about. Then there was a book by John Barry written around 2004 that is now, again, on the bestseller list. But President Bush read that book, and he said, we better be ready in case there's a pandemic. And I worked on the flu plan with President Bush and with others in the Bush administration, and we made sure that we were ready for flu plan. And in fact, when there was a swine flu outbreak in 2009, Bush was no longer in office. But President Obama was now in office, and he dusted off the Bush pandemic plan and used it effectively to help mitigate the impact of that 2009 swine flu. So I think you can learn a lot from history about how to deal with these kinds of issues. I think now people are starting to wake up to the fact that Wilson was ineffective at dealing with the virus, that he said he wouldn't get us into a war, and he did, that he was actually quite racist, unfortunately, and that he also resegregated parts of the federal government. So I think he kind of skated free for a long time and is a much worse president than history for the last 100 years has remembered him as, and I think now he is kind of getting his just and unfortunate due as a poor president.
I want to come back to that paper or the analysis that the President Bush did on the flu pandemic, on pandemics in generally. Did the White House at that point work with Dr. Fauci? Because I know he was close with President George W. Bush's father with regard to the HIV crisis. Was that relationship used in terms of the development of a pandemic policy developed by President George
absolutely.
W. Bush?
Fauci was a crucial player, not only with that, but also with the AIDS plan that President W. Bush put into effect to help limit the spread of AIDS in Africa, an effort that Bush gets insufficient credit for, but that has saved millions of lives in Africa. And Fauci was a regular visitor to the White House, someone with whom I worked a great deal, and was always someone who I greatly admired. And with our political structure and our government, and leaders come and leaders go, Fauci is one of the few permanent pillars of our U.S. government.
Let me ask, I'm going to come back to something we sort of towards the beginning of our conversation. That is, how does a policy in the White House become elevated to the president and result in a legislative proposal or an initiative by the president? How does it come to his attention? Who are the players involved? What type of memorandum is sort of communicated from one office to another within the White House? How does the agencies become involved?
Yeah, the way that policies get promulgated in the White House are really via the staffing process. Somebody could put forward a policy idea or a memo or an idea that goes to the president, and what happens is it has to be staffed. It goes through the staff secretary process. When I was there, it's probably more electronic now, but at the time, there were these memos that would be carried around by the staff secretary's office to all of the key offices within the White House, and they all would have to not only approve it but comment on it. And then staff secretary would have to reconcile the comments. It was quite a time-intensive process, but it's very important because these are the president's words, and anything that comes through the president, that process is the president's official policy. And so I was always amazed at how much time the White House staffers spend on the staffing process, the staffing of documents to make sure that they are all on the same page. In terms of policy idea generation, often it comes from the cabinet secretaries who, around the State of the Union time, starts a couple of months before maybe November, they will give ideas to the White House policy staffers, domestic policy staff where I was, or national economic policy staff. And then what you will have is a process where you kind of cull the ideas. The domestic policy staff will take, let's say, the ideas from HHS or HUD and reduce them to a smaller list. And then they will go into a broader White House meeting where you might have the political people and the chief of staff's office and the intergovernmental affairs people and the senior advisor, all those people sit around the table and they'll say, hey, I like this idea, I like that one. And those ideas then start to filter into the State of the Union. And I always found it very interesting that around Christmas time, when everybody in D.C. seems to be relaxing or resting or taking breaks or going to parties, that's when the White House staff is working most intensely because they are getting ready for the State of the Union. And it's not something that you write the night before, although there have been instances where that happened unsuccessfully, but it's something that takes a lot of time and is done well in advance.
You just mentioned that when we have these discussions or when you had these discussions about policy, political staff is also involved. Now, I assume there were two separate operations in the White House, the policy operation and the political operation. Can you talk about the interaction of those two operations and what happens in an election year when politics sort of becomes a dominant feature in the White House?
Right. So there is an Office of Political Affairs within the White House, but its brief is limited, and there is the White House Counsel's Office, which enforces, or at least advises, on the Hatch Act, which prevents federal employees from engaging in election politicking. So the political office does advise the president on what political implications might be, and it might have interactions with key political leaders, but it is separate from the RNC or the DNC. It is not a political organizing operation. But they would listen to what the advice is on the policies, and they might say, hey, this could resonate well, this might not resonate well. But I got to give props to President Bush here, because I was in the White House during an election year, and he was quite adamant. He brought together the whole cabinet and the senior staff, and he said, look, there's an election coming up. Let me handle the politics. You guys handle the policy. That's your job. You do that. I will handle the politics, and you don't worry about it. You go ahead and do your job. And I think that's an appropriate way of looking at things.
Final question, Tevi. You worked on Capitol Hill, and you worked in the White House. Which was a more interesting and more, I'm trying to think of the white word, that you could do more, that you had the opportunity to accomplish more and see the results of your action, the White House or on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, it's a great question, because on Capitol Hill, if you are behind a piece of legislation, you can actually shepherd that through and make it happen. However, it's kind of hard to do, and most congressmen will introduce way more pieces of legislation than ever have a chance of doing it. If you're at the White House, you are doing things that influence what the president says and also where the president goes. I mean, you really only do two things in the White House. You establish presidential events, or you weigh in on presidential policies. And I think all those can have more impact in the moment, although legislation may be more long-lasting. So I found both of them rewarding. I'm very glad I had the time to serve this great country in government. I had a number of different stints across my 13 years in government, and I'm proud of this country, and I was happy to serve it in those various ways.
With that, I want to thank Tevi Troy, the author of Fight House, for joining us today on Naps Chat. Tevi, I'm sure we'll speak again in the not-too-distant future. And with that, I will wish everyone a great weekend. Take care and see you next week.
Great. See you soon. Thanks.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. I'm going